and even a country boy from the Texas panhandle could identify it as Asian, or more specifically, Korean. Then the lights went out, and they were in complete darkness. Chapter 14. November 3rd. Aboard the Fuchao, near Chabahar, Iran, the Gulf of Oman. Duncan felt his way along the container walls, making his way toward the entrance of the container. Although he couldn't see Park, he sensed his presence as the two men arrived near the table and chairs simultaneously. "Are they hiding or planning an ambush?" asked Park in a barely audible whisper. "If they're hiding, they're not doing a very good job of it," replied Duncan. "They forgot their furniture." "Either way, we gotta decide if we're gonna bust in their weapons hot," said Park. "We could wait on Black Team," said Duncan. "Whoever's in that box is stuck now." Park nudged his partner's arm with his fist. "I have a better idea. Let's give them the universal signal for the jig is up. Nothing says hello, how are you, like racking around into a Mossberg. There's no other sound in the world like that metal on metal." "Agreed. Let's rack one. Pound the sides, and then you holler at them in Korean." "Yeah, we'll give them a chance," said Park as he inched closer to the doorway. Park slid into position as the two men flanked the entrance to the container. After they pulled the slide on their shotguns, they immediately began to pound the side of the container. The racket they caused could have raised the dead. In between the pounding, sounds of screaming and pleas of mercy emanated from the container. Duncan presumed it was Korean, because Park began to engage the occupants in conversation. Between the shouting and the noise created by the duo, the Black Team was alerted, evidenced by the sound of running feet and shouts of instructions that could be heard from the other side of the cargo hold. The lights turned on inside the container, and the doors slowly opened. Two elderly Korean men stepped out with their hands in the air. They were shaking, and one was shedding tears. With the doors open, Duncan could see that the two were not a threat, but he had Park order them to the floor nonetheless. Within minutes, three members of Black Team arrived with their weapons drawn and joined Park in holding the stowaways on the floor at gunpoint. Duncan entered the 40-foot-long sea container, moving his shotgun from side to side in case he was surprised by a gunman. The container didn't contain any more stowaways, but it was far from empty. "Whoa," exclaimed Park as he joined Duncan's side. "What do we have here?" Duncan walked through the container and studied the wooden crates holding various parts of a machine or vehicle. Each container was marked in Korean. "Park, what does it say?" asked Duncan. Park shouldered his weapon and began to walk through the container. At first he mumbled the words, but the more he read, the louder and more excited he became. "Communications antenna, grapple module, attitude control, antenna boom, solar panels, ground link antenna, internal computer." "Come on, man, are you going to tell me what it says?" insisted Duncan. "Dude, I think it's some kind of spacecraft. Maybe a satellite." Duncan walked through the maze of crates and boxes before marching out of the container. He grabbed one of the Koreans and pulled him to his feet. The man held his arms up, pleading for mercy in his native language. Duncan was being intentionally rough with the older man, shoving him forward toward the first container. "What is this for?" he screamed at the old man. He responded in Korean, again appearing to plead for mercy. "Park, ask him," shouted Duncan. Park and the man began to rapidly converse in Korean. Throughout the brief conversation, the man would look in the direction of Duncan, who provided a death stare in return. The man began to sob, and then fell to his knees. "What's his problem?" Duncan asked brusquely. "He's afraid you'll return him to North Korea," replied Park. "The DPRK?" "Yeah. These men are scientists. And this, my friend, is a satellite destined for Tehran. The Iranians are apparently in the satellite business with Pyongyang. And if this guy is telling the truth, they have been for years." Chapter 15. November 4th. Silent Wings Museum, Lubbock, Texas. Major stood toward the rear of the Silent Wings Museum in Lubbock, a facility built in 2002 to honor the former pilots of the U.S. Army and Air Force's glider program utilized in World War II. Their first goal had been to restore the Waco CG-4A glider and display it inside the museum. The facility became an instant local attraction for visitors. Major understood politics enough to know that Governor Marion Burnett was about to speak to some of her staunchest supporters. As politics go, Texas was a deep red state, and the Texas Panhandle was the reddest of the red. In a statewide race, Governor Burnett would focus most of her attention on the parts of the state where so-called independents were abundant, like the counties surrounding large metropolitan areas in Dallas-Fort Worth, Houston, and Austin. This trip to Lubbock was about getting out the votes in the final days of the campaign and pocketing a few campaign donations for her trouble. Major had his check in his pocket and looked forward to talking with his old friend. "My family has been in Texas for generations," said Governor Burnett as she started into her stump speech. "At the Four Sixes Ranch, we started a legacy of cattle, horses, and oil, which continues to this day. Over time, we've grown to nearly 300,000 acres here in the Texas Panhandle. And as I look out into the crowd of friendly and familiar faces, I couldn't be prouder to say I'm a Texan." Major applauded along with the rest of the crowd. He, too, recognized a lot of the faces who were here to pay their respects to the governor looking for a second term. Governor Burnett had done a fine job, in his opinion, and was deserving of re-election. Personally, he thought her rhetoric regarding secession was a little over the top, but he understood politicians felt the need to toss red meat to their loyal base. "As your Texas land commissioner, I am part of this new generation of Texas leadership that fought against the overbearing federal government through their illegal land grabs by the Bureau of Land Management. When those lefty environmentalists entered our state with their high-powered lawyers from California, I stood up to their radical agendas and the trial lawyers' abuse of the Endangered Species Act. And when social justice warriors tried to tear down our historic symbols in the name of political correctness, I said, no, not on my watch." The room burst into a higher level of excitement as the governor continued. She turned to point to a large banner behind her, which was a replica of the Texas state flag. The words "Texas Strong," "Texas Free," were emblazoned across the front of the banner. The room took her cue and began shouting, "Texas Strong, Texas Free, Texas Strong, Texas Free." Major didn't join in the chants, but he did study the crowd. He marveled at how high passions ran on both sides of issues. He was sure that somewhere in the south of Texas, Governor Burnett's opponent had whipped his constituents into a similar frenzy, screaming "La Raza," which was Spanish for "the race." It had become the battle cry of those promoting open borders and unfettered immigration into the United States. "As governor, I've pushed back against Washington. While our friends in the federal government refuse to even consider adopting policies of self-reliance, Texas continues to maintain its own power grid completely separate from the rest of the country. While this administration refuses to prepare for the threats we face from countries around the world who don't like us very much, Texas has adopted policies that will protect all Texans, including those who oppose me, in the event a catastrophic event tears down the nation's power grid. While Washington sticks its head in the sand like an ostrich, Texans can go to sleep at night knowing that this governor has done her part in protecting the lifeblood of any modern society, the electric grid." More raucous applause came from the crowd, and Major even clapped a little louder. Throughout its history, Texas had been fiercely independent. As he and Lucy had adopted a preparedness lifestyle, one that was devoted to the concept of self-reliance under all contingencies, he began to appreciate the work done by Governor Burnett and past Texas governors regarding power grid protection and reliability. Cooper entered through the front door and craned his neck to look for his father. Major had dropped him off at the neurologist's office a short distance away to see if he could get an appointment on short notice. Major waved his son over as the governor continued. "Wow, Daddy, it's loud in here," said Cooper as he slid past a group to join his father. "Yeah, Marion is doing what she does best, whipping him into a frenzy." Did you get to see the doctor? Not yet, but we can stop by in an hour. Will we be done here? Yeah, she's winding it up now. Governor Burnett continued. Unlike other states, Texas has broken away from Washington's control. Other states have become dependent on D.C. dollars to meet their budget shortfalls. Not in Texas, no siree. We balance our budgets on our own. If we can't afford to spend on something, we wait until we can. You see, Washington has imposed its will on the states of this great nation as if they govern with a carrot and a stick. You know, do it our way and we'll give you a carrot. But if you push back or refuse to follow their demands, they'll give you the stick. The crowd began to boo, and Cooper chuckled as he looked up to his father. Major managed to smile and shook his head at the spectacle of politics. Well, Washington, I've got a message for you. You can keep your carrot. And guess what? Our stick's bigger than your stick. And why is that, my friend? Governor Burnett held one hand up to her ear and leaned into the crowd, which immediately answered her question. They crowed at the top of their lungs. Because everything's bigger in Texas. You're dang straight, the governor shouted in return. God bless you, my fellow Texans. Together we will make Texas stronger than ever. The chants began again as Governor Burnett entered the crowd to shake hands. Texas strong, Texas free. Texas strong, Texas free. Chapter 16. November 4th. Lubbock Neurology Clinic, Lubbock, Texas. As they approached the Lubbock Neurology Clinic, Major asked his son, So, what'd you think of the governor? She's really nice. Y'all have known each other since before she got into politics? Quite a long time, actually, replied Major. As you know, the Four Sixes Ranch is located just east of here in Guthrie, on the road to Wichita Falls. Our families have helped one another for decades. Was she like this before she became land commissioner and then governor? Asked Cooper. Marion was always strong-willed. Since she entered politics, she's become hard-nosed. In some respects, almost cold-hearted. What do you mean? Asked Cooper. She's very tough on illegal immigration, Coop. Don't get me wrong. I know those ranchers along the border had their hands full before the border wall was completed. Trust me, it would break my heart to see the dead bodies of those poor souls who made it all this way, only to die of dehydration or at the hands of the traffickers. Once the wall was built, she stopped the illegal immigration. They could, however, still apply for citizenship, right? How's that cold-hearted? It wasn't that. It was her deportation methods. Listen, let's not get into all of this today. Why trouble ourselves with things we can't control, right? Cooper pointed his father into the parking lot, and Major wheeled the big truck into two vacant parking spaces far away from the entrance. I'm guessing politics is not in your future. No way, Daddy. What I saw was no different than an evangelical preacher under a tent handling snakes. She had those folks so worked up that if she shouted march to Washington and shoot all the politicians, they would have done it. Coop, I wonder sometimes, muttered his father. Cooper led the way into the Lubbock Neurology Clinic, which was nationally known for its state-of-the-art diagnostic equipment and neurotrauma care. After Cooper signed in, he and his father sat alone in the waiting area, like a couple of old men waiting for the next available barber. After several minutes of silence, Cooper spoke up. Daddy, you and I have made a lot of secret deals the last few days. That we have, son. Listen, you can't let Riley or Palmer know that you've come with me today. We have this secret deal of our own. Major began to laugh. Doesn't appear this family is very good at keeping secrets. Cooper continued. Well, it's not a big one, but we kind of have a kid's pact that what happens on the road stays on the road. You know, like the folks in Vegas are always saying. Okay. So what are you saying? Asked Major. Well, when they took me to the hospital, after I woke up, I made them both swear to live up to our pact. And they did. So I can't have you telling them that you know about what happened. Okay? Major busted out laughing so loud that the receptionists rose out of their chairs to see what the uproar was. Major surmised it wasn't likely that any neurology patients had much to laugh about. He held his hands up to indicate to them everything was okay, What? Asked Cooper. Son, your sister spilled the beans to Miss Lucy the next day. Let's just say a mother's intuition is most often right. No child can withstand your mama's interrogation techniques. Cooper shook his head. Are you referring to the look? That's the one. She's used the look on me for as long as we've known one another, which is why I had to fib to her after the lights were turned out the night y'all came home. I reckon she didn't buy it for one second. Great, said Cooper with a laugh. Palmer broke the code. Actually, son, you did first, remember? Cooper threw himself back in the seat and laughed. I reckon I did. A nurse entered the waiting room. Mr. Armstrong? Father and son responded in unison. Yes? The nurse studied them both and said, I need the Mr. Armstrong with the busted noggin. Cooper and Major pointed at one another. That's him. The nurse grinned, rolled her eyes, and motioned for the guys to join her. Major thought to himself, no sense of humor around here. Cooper, you're a grown man, and I can only caution you on what's best based upon your injury, started the doctor. There's no way that I can sign off on a rodeo event for you in a week. Granted, your injury was minor compared to others. We still need to follow a post-concussive protocol. Doc, we went through the list of symptoms, Cooper protested. You said the neck pain was the only thing of concern. That's getting better every day. That's good, and your recovery is remarkable, considering you were kicked by a pissed-off bull. When dealing with post-concussion syndrome, those initial weeks are critical. Some people may have the telltale signs, such as headaches, dizziness, or vision problems right away. For others, the symptoms don't manifest themselves for weeks. Okay, I understand. Cooper was clearly dejected. If he couldn't ride at the next rodeo, that gave him only one more chance at the Calgary Stampede on Thanksgiving weekend. There would be no margin for error. Cooper, you have to be very careful over the next several weeks, the doctor continued. Experiencing a second concussion in this time frame, what we call second impact syndrome, before the signs and symptoms of your first trauma have been resolved, could result in rapid and sometimes fatal brain swelling. A concussion, even a minor one like yours, changes the levels of brain chemicals. It usually takes a week for these levels to stabilize again, but recovery time varies. From my examination of you, I believe you're on the road to recovery. Just don't exacerbate your injury. Cooper shut down. So Major addressed the neurologist. Doctor, I can speak for my son and assure you he will heal fully before he gets anywhere near a bull, or I'll knock him upside the head myself. The doctor laughed, and even Cooper managed to smile. During his quiet moment, he was calculating. Let's see, I got kicked on October 29th. Today's November 4th. That's 7 days. If I skip the next ride, that takes me all the way to Thanksgiving, which is the 24th. That's 20 more days, for a total of 27. That's pretty near a month. I'll be good to go. The doctor and his father were still making small talk as a wide grin crossed Cooper Armstrong's face. Chapter 17. November 5th. Home of Secretary of Defense Montgomery Gregg. Georgetown, Washington, D.C. Secretary Gregg asked his wife to turn in without him. She'd learned, over their 30 years of marriage, not to question her husband when he became this serious. The secretary was loyal to all who returned the favor, and Mrs. Gregg never once wondered if he had strayed. Since their arrival, the late evening visits from mysterious men had become commonplace. She didn't question him, and he never volunteered to tell her the subject matter. A steady rap at the door indicated his guests had arrived. Secretary Gregg lifted himself out of the leather chair, which flanked the large stone fireplace in his study. He allowed the cigar to burn, the smoke easily finding its way to a heat source and up the chimney. Secretary Gregg was not a drinker, but he allowed himself a quality cigar from time to time, when the mood warranted. He opened the heavy oak door and welcomed in his guests, the most frequent visitors to the Gregg home in Georgetown. He nodded to his security team and closed the doors behind the two men, who quickly moved into the foyer and began to remove their overcoats. Washington had experienced a cooling trend as November arrived. Monty, thank you for seeing us on short notice, said Carl Braun, the director of the Special Activities Division of the National Clandestine Service, who was arguably the nation's top spy. Braun had spent his entire career in government service within the FBI, CIA, and now as head of the Special Activities Division of the NCS. Of course, said Secretary Gregg. He extended his hand to shake Braun's. Then he addressed Braun's companion, Billy Yancey, a fellow Texan and the head of the Political Action Group, or PAG, within the NCS. PAG was responsible for covert activities related to political regime change, economic warfare, and psychological operations. Secretary Gregg was surprised at the unannounced attendance of his old friend. Billy, didn't expect to see you tonight. Hello, Monty, said Yancey. There's been a game-changer, and it requires a conversation between all of us. Us? Asked Secretary Gregg as he led the men into his study. He reached for his cigar box and opened the lid, offering one to his guests. They both passed. Monty, based upon this conversation, we may have to go to others whose departments are directly impacted by our decision. Sounds serious. Take a seat, gentlemen, and tell me what's happened. To most Americans, the government was run by a large, wholly encompassing federal government whose tentacles controlled most aspects of our daily lives. What didn't fall under the purview of Washington was delegated to the 50 states. Very little happened in an individual's daily activities that wasn't controlled by or supplemented with government actions. What most Americans suspect, but can't necessarily prove, was that there was a cabal of sorts, deeply rooted in the administrative apparatus of Washington, that operated independently of the elected officials who run the government. These long-term career public servants achieved a position of power by sheer longevity in their positions, or through the careful exploitation of the system, which allowed for the acquisition of power. Political scientists and foreign policy experts have referred to these individuals as being part of the deep state, a term used to describe those who exercise power independent of, and oftentimes in contravention of, elected political leaders. Secretary Gregg, Undersecretary Yancey, and Director Braun were not only part of the deep state, they were three of a dozen who acted as final decision makers. When Braun called the meeting, Secretary Gregg knew it was important. When Billy Yancey showed up at the front door, it meant the subject matter most likely meant one thing. North Korea. "I'll get right to it, Monty," started Braun. "Two of our field operatives were on post in the Gulf of Oman and participated in a VBSS of a Singapore-flagged freighter we've had the NSA monitoring. There was a container and two passengers under South Korean passports added to the ship's manifest at the 11th hour, which caught the eye of a CIA analyst." "What did they find?" asked Secretary Gregg. "In addition to the two North Korean scientists, the container held parts for a medium-sized, low-Earth orbiting satellite," replied Braun. "Destination?" "We believe they were headed for Iran," Braun replied. "During the initial interrogation, the scientists admitted that Pyongyang has been working with Tehran for years on their satellite program. Once we got them under the microscope of one of our dark facilities, they told us about a technology-sharing arrangement between the DPRK and Iran. That explains how North Korea's nuclear program advanced so rapidly during the period from 2010 through 2016, added Secretary Gregg. "We always suspected as much, but Iran was hands-off during those years, if you remember." "As a result," added Yancey, "we have a nuclear Iran and North Korea, both of which are now increasing their nuclear weapons stockpiles in complete defiance of those idiots in the United Nations." Secretary Gregg put out his cigar and tossed it into the fireplace. "Okay, so how is the satellite a game changer? I mean, both countries have been launching satellites for years. It confirms that the nations are trading technology and actively working together," replied Braun. "And I might add, it provides a potential weapon for both countries to be used against the West." "An EMP," said Yancey. "Do you think they have the technology to strap a nuclear warhead to a satellite?" asked Secretary Gregg. Braun nodded. "According to our singing scientists, they've already done it. But let me say this. Towards the end of our enhanced interrogation techniques, those two might have admitted being space aliens. That said, all the pieces of the puzzle seemed to fit. Secretary Gregg rolled his head around his shoulders and stood to stare out onto 35th Street. With his back to his guests, he asked, "Why hasn't little Un pulled the trigger? He's been blustering for years." "We think he's waiting until his nuclear arsenal is sufficient to back us down in case we threaten to retaliate," replied Braun. "Taking down a nation's power grid is one thing. Nuking the hell out of him is another." "Ironic, isn't it?" asked Secretary Gregg rhetorically. "He takes the same position as our president. Those two should get together." Braun reached into his coat pocket and removed a sterling silver flask. He took a swig of the brandy and offered it to Yancey, who declined. Braun continued, "The theory is that an electromagnetic pulse attack is a non-lethal use of a nuclear weapon. It doesn't result in direct loss of life." "So naive," muttered Secretary Gregg, who finally turned around and returned to his seat. He looked to his friend from Texas. "Billy, you haven't had much to say thus far. I take it you're not along for the ride?" "That's right, Monty. I have a proposal." Secretary Gregg spread his arms out in front of him. "Let's hear it." "We take him out," Yancey replied. Secretary Gregg shrugged and then chuckled. "A first strike. The president wouldn't even consider it. No, Monty. We'll send in a team to assassinate Kim Jong-un." "Come on, guys," said Secretary Gregg. "With all due respect, the DMZ is full of the graves of commandos who've tried to kill the great leader or dear leader or any other members of the Kim dynasty for decades." "Hear me out, Monty," said Yancey. "We've got an angle. It better be a good one. We've got a mole, an accomplice, if you will, high up and close to Kim Jong-un." Secretary Gregg laughed again. "Who? One of his wives? A concubine? They know nothing of his activities." "Nope, better than that," replied Yancey. "His most trusted advisor, friend, and family member. Someone who wants the reins, but who is interested in another path for the Hermit Kingdom." Secretary Gregg suddenly got very serious. He sat forward in his chair and looked both men in the eye. "Are you kidding me? You turned little sis, Kim Yo-jong. No way." "We have," replied Yancey. "She will work with us to eliminate her brother from power so that she can lead the country. There are conditions, namely related to autonomy and protection from the South and China, but we can make it happen." "Why doesn't she just do it herself?" asked Secretary Gregg. "It has to be from the outside, otherwise her transition would be doomed from the beginning," replied Braun. "When?" "With your approval, we'll set the plan in motion for immediate implementation," replied Braun. Secretary Gregg reached for another cigar, cut off the end, and lit it, allowing a cloud of smoke to float into the air, reminiscent of a nuclear explosion. "Let's put a plan together." Part 2. Chapter 18. November 6th. The Armstrong Ranch, Borden County, Texas. Roscoe "Pops" Armstrong, a lifelong teetotaler, had a saying, "There are only two liquids in my life, water and oil. My body is made up of one, and usually I'm held hostage by the other." Tens of thousands of wells dotted the Texas landscape, some drilled in areas the Spaniards once declared to be despoblado, or no man's land. These parts of Texas were so dry nothing could survive because they lacked one crucial element of life. Water. Borden County, Texas, nearly a third of which was made up of the Armstrong Ranch, was part of the Southern High Plains, an area encompassing eastern New Mexico and into the western panhandles of Oklahoma and Texas. In most years, the geographic region receives about 24 inches of rain. The vast majority of the precipitation on the southern high plains never reaches the ground, having been lost to evaporation in the upper atmosphere. The water-challenged plains are dominated by tall prairie grasses, creosote bushes, and mesquite plants. It was the visionary rancher who bought up land along the meandering rivers and lakes of the Panhandle to irrigate their fields and provide groundwater to their wells. When Pops purchased this part of the Armstrong Ranch in the late 50s at a bank foreclosure, the water levels of the river were much higher. A single windmill stood on the tract and was restored by Pops in the 60s. Only 60 feet from the river, the well had been drilled to 70 feet, which was great news for Armstrong Ranch. With the groundwater at such a shallow depth, they would be able to expand their oil production, as well as provide enough water to expand the grazing areas of their steers. He was able to triple the size of this herd. Major insisted on keeping the windmill and the well operable, despite the fact that it pumped a meager 5 gallons per minute into the water trough that fed Miss Lucy's barnyard critters. He considered the windmill and its riverside location to be a sacred spot, one that symbolized the waters necessary to sustain the lives within his charge. Over the years, the river began to recede as more landowners upriver toward Lubbock began to divide up the resource and depleted it for their own ranching operations and oil wells. This issue began to create friction between the ranchers. Ranchers who had mineral rights were able to sell that precious water for $1 a barrel to an oil company for use in drilling. Each well could use as much as 2 million gallons of water, the state's rarest of assets. Soon the state established laws and guidelines to prevent the unlawful overuse of the precious resource. The Armstrong family, through Pops, stood at the forefront of the effort and used their influence on the Texas Land Commissioner to marshal this precious asset in Borden County. As a result, they became stewards of the Colorado River in the county, and the state granted them an additional 1,400 acres, which encompassed nearly half of Natural Dam Lake. In exchange, the Armstrongs agreed to keep the river flowing into the lake free of obstructions and debris. Major and Cooper stood next to one another, under the branches of a cottonwood, marveling at the workmanship of the beaver colony. The water had backed up, creating a half-acre lake that caused the water levels to rise near the windmill. "It's a shame we have to do this," started Cooper. "I wish we could harness the energy of these little guys. They get more work done in a day than half a dozen of preacher's boys." "Come on now, lay off the ranch hands, unless you want to do their work for them," said Major, who had always been appreciative of the Armstrong employees. He prided himself in creating loyal, long-term ranch hands, rare in this day of low unemployment across Texas. Labor had never been a problem for him as a result. For many ranches, operating on thin margins, there was the temptation to hire illegals and pay them cash. Major didn't want to embarrass himself and the family by going against the governor. She'd provided his family too many accommodations in the past, such as the land grant for half the lake, to insult her over saving a few bucks on labor. "What's the plan, Daddy?" asked Riley, who had just arrived in the farm truck, a beat-up Chevy that was used to drop hay bales around the ranch in remote locations. "Are we going to blast him?" "What?" asked the major. "Do you want to blast the beavers or the dam?" Riley kicked at some rocks in the dust near his feet, clearly feeling the brunt of his father's admonishing tone. "Nah, Daddy, it's just that I was reading up about explosives on the Internet last night. Did y'all know that you can purchase everything you need to make a bomb on Amazon?" "Come on, Riley," said Cooper with a laugh. "It's true, Coop. There are certain ingredients that are innocent on their own, but when combined together, they produce explosives. You can buy the ingredients to make black powdered thermite, steel ball bearings for shrapnel, igniters, and even remote detonators." "Son, we have plenty of explosives around here to deal with prairie dogs and tree stumps." Cooper added, "Mama hates us blowing up the prairie dogs, but I swear the little devils are born pregnant. It's amazing how fast they breed." "Well, not to mention they carry diseases like the plague," said Major. "That's the last thing we need around here." "No kidding," said Cooper, turning his attention back to the beaver dam. "That ammonium nitrate does the trick. Why don't we just use it on the beaver dam?" Major looked behind him and around the gently sloped landscape that rose up from the river. "Because Miss Lucy threatened me within an inch of my life this morning that we better not take out any beavers in the process. It wouldn't surprise me if she was out here somewhere, watching. I'm telling y'all, we could blow up the dam with those ingredients from Amazon and not have to use the big stuff like what we keep in the shed," interjected Riley. Major put his arm around Riley's shoulders. "Son, I'm no expert on using the Internet like you and your mama. Google is my friend when I want to research something. I have my favorite websites I visit to get news from different perspectives, knowing full well you can't believe everything you read on the internet. I know that, Daddy. Here's something I hope you've learned, Major continued. There's something on these websites called cookies. Do you know what that means? Yes, sir. It's when you visit a site, the internet kind of follows you around, suggesting similar websites or advertisers. Why do you ask? Major stifled a laugh. Well, son, are you desirous of importing yourself a Korean bride? I mean, ain't we got enough pretty Texas girls to choose from? Cooper crashed against the side of the truck, laughing hysterically. He could barely spit out the words. Korean brides? Really? No. Well, it's not like that, y'all, protested Riley. Once I accidentally clicked on a picture of this girl. I mean, dang it, Coop, shut up. Cooper was still laughing so hard he had to wipe the tears away from his face. Riley took off his cowboy hat and slapped his leg with it. His face was beet red with embarrassment. Now listen up, boys, Major began as he tried to defuse the situation before Riley got mad at his brother. Miss Lucy has lived with a family boy since the day I married her, and that includes your sister, who's pert near a boy herself. She's seen plenty from all of us, and she decided early on that being surrounded by cowboys was the life she wanted. But do me a favor, stay off the Korean bride websites, and know this. The first half-naked woman that shows up on Miss Lucy's iPad will result in a row none of us want to be a part of. Am I clear? Yes, sir, replied Riley sheepishly. He always took criticism hard. Coop, that applies to you as well, son. Loud and clear, Daddy. Cooper gave his brother a playful shove. Let's get to work. How do you want to do this? The rumble of heavy machinery could be heard coming over the hill. Years ago, Major had gone to an equipment auction and invested in a backhoe, as well as a bobcat. These became indispensable tools on the ranch for fencing, spreading manure in the garden, and now beaver dam modification. Boys, we're going to leave the dam in place, started Major, who quickly continued when he saw the puzzled looks on the boys' faces. My agreement with the state is to keep the water flowing in the lake. It isn't to blow up beaver dams. You see how much water has accumulated upriver in a short period of time? The water had risen several feet, causing a newly formed lake of nearly an acre. As the water rose, the beavers built the structure higher. I know, it's amazing, said Riley. Preacher and the ranch hands pulled alongside the farm truck and began to unload 10-foot sections of PVC pipe. I'm always thinking ahead, boys, said Major. You never know when circumstances might dictate that we control the flow of water for our own benefit. Governments change their minds, and you can find yourself at their mercy. I think it would be wise to take advantage of what our beaver friends have done and prepare for unforeseen events. Cooper turned to watch the guys unload. What's all that stuff for? Today, we're going to install what's called a beaver pipe. They're usually used to prevent beavers from damming up the water. We'll install it for that purpose, except with a slight modification. If the time comes that we need to shut off the downriver flow, we'll be able to cap the pipe and allow the water to accumulate here, for the benefit of our ranch. How's it work? Asked Riley. We'll use the backhoe to cut a notch in the beaver dam near the bank. This will work to drain the water levels into the lake. Then we'll insert the pipes into the notch and secure them with steel fence posts to create a gradual drop from the higher ground toward the lake. On the riverside, we'll cap the pipe at a level that allows for the water to back up and create our lake. Won't the beavers try to repair the breach? Asked Cooper. I'm counting on it. Once it's installed, we'll stand out of the way and let the beavers do the rest. As the water begins to flow through the notch, the beavers will quickly move to stop the flow over and around the pipes, sealing them under the dam. The water level will rise once again, and when it reaches our pipe, it will begin to flow down toward the lake. We will have built a new lake, yet allowed the free flow of water to be in compliance with the state mandate. Cooper shook his head in disbelief. This is brilliant, and just in time for the winter snows, which fill the river anyway. Here's the thing, boys, started Major. Your mama and I have adopted a mindset, a way of thinking that goes beyond living our day-to-day lives. It involves planning, preparation, and in a way, prognostication.
Like a crystal ball? Asked Riley.
I guess you could say that, replied his dad. It's like adopting a certain mentality, I guess. Like most aspects of your life, it comes down to making choices. Years ago, we committed to a self-sustainable preparedness lifestyle. We took the best of Lucy's homesteading techniques, coupled it with preparedness tips I'd picked up over the years, and combined it into a well-organized plan designed to keep us safe if something bad happens around us.
Bad, like catastrophic? Asked Cooper.
That's right, Coop. Listen, I've always allowed you boys to give me a hard time about watching the news and keeping up with world events. But the fact of the matter is we live in dangerous times. Our nation faces many threats, both man-made from countries who hate us, and natural disasters. Miss Lucy and I recognized years ago, especially after 9/11, that our personal lives are subject to unexpected setbacks, and our world is fraught with danger. We decided then to protect our family against all possible threats. We love you boys, as well as Duncan and Palmer. If the crap hits the fan, we'll be ready. Make sense?
Cooper and Riley looked at one another and nodded. The boys began to understand where their father was coming from.
Here's the thing, guys. The day before catastrophic events occurred, from Pearl Harbor to 9/11, to that massive tsunami in Japan, folks were going about their daily lives, not giving a second thought to what might turn their world upside down. All I'm saying is that when it comes to catastrophic events, we never know when the day before is the day before, so we prepare for tomorrow.
Chapter 19 November 6th Texas Gubernatorial Debate, KERA-TV Studios, Dallas, Texas. After a long day of swiping away pesky beavers and sloshing through the muddy bottom of the Colorado River, the beaver pipe was installed, and the guys found their way back to the house. It was 8 o'clock by the time they'd cleaned up and finished dinner. Miss Lucy entered the family room with mugs of coffee and hot chocolate for everyone as the temperatures that night dipped down into the mid-40s. Major had turned the DirecTV to the local Lubbock station to settle in for the final debate between Governor Burnett and her opponent. Governor Burnett, as the incumbent, enjoyed a comfortable lead in the polls, and barring an unforced error, would easily win on Election Day. The debate had been uneventful and lacked a game-changing moment. The narrators, all Dallas television news hosts, had been relatively fair in their questioning. The next issue to discuss, Texas power grid independence, was intended to show the divide between the two candidates on the future of ERCOT, the Electric Reliability Council of Texas.
Governor Burnett, this question is for you, said the moderator. Governor Burnett smiled and readied herself by taking a drink of water.
ERCOT manages the flow of electricity to 28 million Texans, or 90% of the state. This independent system manages 46,000 miles of transmission lines and nearly 600 generation units. Many experts have claimed that ERCOT's ability to produce cost-effective energy with a low environmental impact is admirable, but that the state, and you in particular, should be chastised for not sharing with others, namely the Western and Eastern Interconnected Grid, which serves much of the continental United States. How do you respond, Governor?
Well, it's no secret that Texas has a bit of an independent streak, stated Governor Burnett, to the chuckle of the small audience packed into the newly built auditorium at KERA-TV just for this purpose. I have to give credit to prior administrations for following this path of independence and creating a power grid that was not beholden to the federal government. When President Roosevelt signed the Revised Federal Power Act in 1935, yet another in a long line of socialist power grabs, pardon the pun, in response to the Great Depression, Texas utilities came together and avoided crossing state lines. Throughout our history as a state, we've believed that freedom from federal regulation was a cherished goal. Our state has been built upon a mindset of self-reliance, and the energy companies in those early days relied upon our abundance of coal, natural gas, and petroleum resources to fuel our power plants.
"Governor, may I interrupt you there?" said the moderator.
"It appears you just did," Governor Burnett bristled. She had little use for the media, whether friend or foe.
"Governor, there have been occasions where Texas was forced to call upon other adjacent utilities for power when ERCOT customers were underserved."
"That is true, and it has happened on rare occasion, which is why we maintain a working relationship with our partners in El Paso, Lubbock, and Beaumont to pick up the slack. Despite those isolated regions being outside of the ERCOT power network, we do help one another at times."
"What about Mexico?" asked the moderator.
"What about Mexico?" Governor Burnett fired back. She took another drink of water and glanced over at her opponent, addressing him directly.
"Am I debating you or these people?"
The debate moderator continued.
"Governor, there have been occasions where ERCOT has received power from Mexico, correct?"
"Sure, once. So let's not over-exaggerate, shall we? In 2011, a decade or more ago, the state experienced rolling blackouts and imported some power from Mexico. At the time, ERCOT had three ties to the grid in Mexico, and the governor elected to tap into that resource for a short-term fix. That has not happened since, and ERCOT has taken measures to prevent it from happening again."
"Governor, are you opposed to the Southern Cross project, which has been endorsed by your opponent?" asked the moderator.
The Southern Cross Project was a proposed transmission line capable of transferring enough electricity for hundreds of thousands of homes between East Texas and Mississippi. The project was to be financed by private investors and carried a $2 billion price tag. Southern Cross had been proposed by the Department of Energy to help Mississippi and Louisiana recover from hurricanes. The governor responded without hesitation.
"I've been clearly against it. Listen, I'm sorry for the problems our neighboring states might have following a storm. We've had our share, and Texans always pull together to help one another. From the first time I announced my run for the governor's office, I let Texans know who I was and what I stood for. I stand for Texas and Texans. What happens beyond our borders is not my concern. You can call me an isolationist, selfish, a horrible person. I don't really care what names or labels you throw at me. Blowing out someone else's candles won't make yours shine any brighter."
Governor Burnett leaned forward into the camera, revealed her toothy signature smile, and paused before finishing her statement.
"A strong, self-reliant Texas is a free Texas. Texans who agree with me will vote their conscience on Tuesday. You can take that to the bank."
Chapter 20. November 7th. Oval Office. The White House. Washington, D.C. President Harmon studied the faces of her chief of staff, Charles Acton, and her chief political strategist, Jackie Jennings, a longtime political operative who'd worked for campaigns on both sides of the aisle and was known for candid, apolitical analysis of any issue that an administration faced. Her closest confidants had arrived prior to the president's daily brief in order to inform her of an early morning vote at the United Nations General Assembly. As the verbal battle escalated between the United States and North Korea, news surfaced that Kim Jong-un had ordered another intercontinental ballistic missile test. After the president had been sworn in, she immediately labeled the North Korean hostilities the biggest threat to America's sovereignty in modern times. At the time, she drew the proverbial line in the sand, stating that further ICBM testing by Kim would be met with military force in the form of U.S. missile defense systems shooting down their rockets. Since that statement, the North Koreans had tested their ICBM missiles twice, and the president stood down. Now they were readying for a third launch in 7 months, and the president ordered the ambassador to the United Nations to take action. The UN ambassador lobbied the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, to stand with the United States in approving new sanctions against the Pyongyang government. The proposed resolution would ban North Korean imports of coal, iron, lead, iron ore, and seafood products that were worth over $1 billion a year to the North Korean economy. This embargo, on a third of the nation's gross domestic product, represented the single largest set of sanctions ever leveled against the dictator.
The U.S. ambassador argued to the Southeast Asian countries that the threat of a rogue nation like North Korea would impact all of them if war broke out in the region. She also encouraged them to discourage any joint venture agreements with North Korean companies. Harmon stood in front of her desk and waited for her advisors to take seats opposite one another on the sofas. Neither spoke up, so she started the conversation.
"Well, out with it. What happened?" she demanded.
Chief of Staff Acton spoke first.
"Not good, Madam President. The entire assembly turned against us. The measure was soundly defeated."
"You've got to be kidding," said President Harmon, both confused and angry. "We had the support of Aishan, the countries in the region who stand to lose the most if war breaks out."
"The vote was 91-2. Only Israel stood with us."
President Harmon shook her head in disbelief and fell into a wing chair between the two sofas. Her slumped posture was indicative of her mood.
"It actually gets worse, Madam President," started Jennings. "The Secretary General issued a stunning rebuke of our request. He urged us to stop taking advantage of the international community's goodwill with continued provocations of the North. He said that we've, quote, engaged in harmful verbal discourse against North Korea, and that none of our fears have materialized."
Jennings stopped and gestured to Acton to elaborate.
"Our belief is the Chinese have flexed their muscle in favor of their ally. They've been actively working behind the scenes with their Southeast Asian neighbors, both politically and economically. At this point, only the Philippines, South Korea, and Japan stand with us."
"With the Philippines and South Korea gradually distancing themselves from our hardline policy," interjected Jennings. "The fact of the matter is we've complained for decades about the North Korean nuclear program, and nothing has come to fruition. I believe we've screamed fire in the movie theater once too often."
President Harmon stood up and retrieved a bottled water from her desk. She stared out the windows of the Oval Office onto the South Lawn, where the leaves had changed color and begun to fall.
"The world has turned against us," she surmised, "just that quickly."
Acton continued with his analysis. "Madam President, this would have been the 8th round of sanctions imposed upon the DPRK, none of which have deterred their nuclear goals. We have taken every step imaginable to stem the advance of their ICBM and nuclear program to no avail."
"Jackie, how is this playing in the polling and focus groups?" asked the President, who was always aware of the political ramifications of every decision she made.
"First, with respect to today's vote, it won't impact your favorables at all, and will have no impact on the midterms tomorrow," responded Jennings. "The issue is more a long-term one."
President Harmon addressed her advisers. "I'm getting pressure from the Pentagon. My whole national security team is urging us to take action to stop the proliferation, and based upon this morning's UN lack of action, we apparently are on an island here, all alone with our loyal and faithful friends in Jerusalem. I've got to make a decision here."
"Do you?" asked Jennings. The President tilted her head slightly, trying to discern the meaning of the question. Jennings continued. "I mean, really? Do you need to make a decision? For nearly 4 decades, presidents have made the same moves you have with respect to North Korea. Public statements, back-channel negotiations, and UN sanctions. Nothing has worked, yet nothing has happened, either. Why not continue to play this charade with Kim Jong-un?"
"Madam President," interrupted Acton, "I think Jackie may have a point. We're in a catch-22 when it comes to North Korea, and the world knows it. If we undertake a first strike, world opinion may come down on us hard, or worse. China may stand up for their ally and retaliate on their behalf. North Korea will go after the South and Japan. Iran may use our weakened condition and decide to take on Israel and the Saudis. Who knows what the Russians might do?"
"I get it. A first strike may bring matters to a head, but we may not be pleased with the results," said the President. "Secretary Gregg and his staff will have the floor during today's PDB to outline our first strike options and our defensive positioning. Let's see what he has to say, and then we'll make a decision that's based upon military options and additional diplomatic approaches."
Chapter 21. November 7th. Roosevelt Room. The White House. Washington, D.C. Only students of history and military strategists fully understood North Korea's attitude toward the rest of the world. Most don't realize the tiny nation's moniker as the Hermit Kingdom applied long before its modern isolationist policies of the last 70 years. For centuries, Korea had been under siege by the Mongols, who slaughtered 200,000 men, women, and children as they embarked upon their East Asian scorched earth conquests. Then the Manchu invasions from China in the 1600s replaced repeated Japanese wars that plagued the Korean peninsula. This was a nation that knew nothing but war. But it wasn't until the last great power clash after World War II, when Soviet and American political leaders agreed to divide the Korean peninsula along the 38th parallel in the name of peace, that North Korea truly pulled within itself and gave rise to the Kim dynasties for decades to come. Beginning with Kim Il-sung's repeated provocative actions against South Korea through the rhetoric of the Kim Jong-un regime, the DPRK dictators had shown little regard for global political opinion, and even less for the lives of the North Korean people. The regimes had adopted a communist-style division system, which had failed miserably. Kim Jong-un's only means upon which to hold power was to isolate his people from outside influences and continue to blame others, namely the United States, for the people's poor living conditions. By casting blame everywhere else and instilling fear of military attacks upon their country, Pyongyang rallied its people against a common enemy for the hope of a better life someday. In 1951, during the Korean War, when General Douglas MacArthur was unceremoniously dumped by President Harry Truman for insubordination, he dared to disagree with the president publicly on the progress of the war. He was very vocal in stating the United States should drive the communists from the North to create a stable, unified Korean peninsula. President Truman disagreed, instead adopting a limited war approach, which did not include regime change, but strictly focused on driving the North Korean army back across the 38th parallel. MacArthur disagreed. Maintaining a divided Korea would necessarily result in instability in the region. The general, who famously said, "Old soldiers never die, they just fade away," knew 70 years ago what the rest of the world had come to accept. The North Korean problem was not going to fade away. "Madam President," started Secretary of State Jane Tompkins, "before I turn the floor over to Secretary of State Gregg, I can confirm through our conversations with the Chinese ambassador that North Korea is readying another nuclear test at their facility in Kaesong. Their primary test site, especially for nuclear weapons, has collapsed." "What do you mean by collapsed?" asked Chief of Staff Acton. "Their missile testing site adjacent to Mount Mantap in the northern part of the country has been experiencing what's known as tired mountain syndrome," continued Secretary Tompkins. "Recent USGS reports have indicated their underground nuclear testing and detonations have taken its toll on the surrounding rock mass and along the tectonic faults. Several tremors have been recorded, and then, late last night, a strong 6.6 magnitude earthquake was reported." A representative of the NSA interrupted and began to hand out some photographs. "Madam President, one of our birds flew over this morning and have provided the following imagery. As you can see, the image on split-screen left is the original testing site. On the right, you can see a chasm has opened up and the missile launch pad was swallowed by the earth." "The development hasn't slowed them down, has it?" asked Chief of Staff Acton. "No, sir, it hasn't," replied Secretary Gregg. "We suspect the North Korean geologists anticipated this, which is why they relocated their next ICBM missile test to Kaesong, hundreds of miles away." "Do we have an estimated date for this new test?" asked President Harmon. "We do, Madam President, based upon our past observations," replied a representative from the CIA. "Once site preparations begin, the launch takes place within 2 to 3 weeks, pending weather." "Okay. Keep me posted, naturally," said the president. "Today, as you know, we suffered a stunning defeat in the United Nations General Assembly. I want to make one thing perfectly clear. This does not mean we are going to abandon our diplomatic efforts or any other types of overt political pressure at our disposal.
With that said, I've asked Secretary Gregg to brief us on our defense options, and then what our first strike strategy looks like. Every time Kim Jong-un readies another ICBM missile launch, we have to work under the assumption it's meant for us or our allies. General. General Gregg stood and instructed his aide to bring up